Tonight's show is sponsored by Kathy. Hey, that's me. This is Goofy.
No, it's great. You are the sponsor tonight.
Oh. She makes the coffee that keeps us going?
See, that sounded great.
It still needs some work, Jerry. I'm going to go make some coffee. I still think it sounded goofy.
High on a mountainside near the asylum in the ghost town of Jerome, Arizona, you are listening to Jerry and Kathy Wills.
You don't know why.
Comments and views expressed on the Jerry Wills Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect those of Jerry Wills, the Jerry Wills Show, the affiliates or sponsors, or Channel U.
And welcome to another edition of the Jerry Wills Show. We have a bit of a late start this evening because I made a mistake and pushed a button earlier in the day. I'll briefly explain. I was doing video editing for the new Healer series, of which you're about to meet Rod Haber, the man who wrote the book. Anyway, and I was so wrapped up in doing editing that there is a little red button that I have to push in order for sound to go from one computer to the other so I can monitor through my system here what the audio is either on that computer over there or the computer here, the console. I was frantically trying to figure out what the hell was wrong. Anyway, I did. The button needed to be pushed, and here I am. So I apologize for the delay. I know some of you have been waiting for a bit. Certainly we'll try to make this show worth your while for having stuck around. As I said a few moments ago, our guest this evening is Rod Haber. He wrote the book. He's an author. He's not the only book he's ever written, but he wrote the book called Healer, the Jerry Wills Story. We're going to go into the background from the time that I met Rod all the way through to writing the book. We're going to cover a lot of territory tonight. I do have the phone lines standing by, and I will open the phone lines during the second hour. I'll be announcing that when the time comes. So you can ask Rod questions if you have a question. And as you know, you can call us from anywhere on Earth. Our friend Dimitri calls from Russia. It doesn't matter where you are. It's a free call for you, whether you're local or long distance. So before wasting any more time, I want to bring my friend, my pal for many years, Rod Haber, and let's get the show on the road. Hello, Rod. How are you?
Hello, Jerry. I'm good. Thanks for having me on tonight.
It really is such a privilege to have you on here with us this evening. You heard what I was telling everyone. You know, we go back quite a number of years. I don't even know how many. Kathy and I have been together for 25 years. And it was shortly after we got together that you and I met.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's about right.
Yeah, that's about right. You have been historically, you're not working now, you're retired, but you have historically been working in Phoenix for Fox News. Tell us a little bit about that, Rod.
Sure. I came to Fox News. Now, this is the local Phoenix affiliate, KSAZ, in 1996, after starting with Fox up in Salt Lake. And I came here as an executive producer for the news operation at Channel 10 here in Phoenix, Fox 10. And part of my job was to explore what we called enterprise stories, unique things that we could promote that no one else was airing. You know, 90% of local news, stabbings, fires, murders, things like that. So that took me out of that realm, and I was actually working in an area where I could, you know, explore new and different things. And part of the job was to tie in stories with our lead-in audiences. And it just so happened in 1996, Fox was running a program from 8 to 9 on Friday nights called The X-Files. Probably your viewers probably remember that.
Oh, sure.
Very interesting show, you know, exploring paranormal, UFOs, all kinds of stuff. It's very interesting stuff, and the ratings were very good. So one of the things I had to do was find stories for our 9 p.m. news following X-Files that would capture that X-Files audience, that would interest those people who are watching X-Files. That's part of what we do in TV news to, you know, get more people in the house, get higher ratings, and make more money, because it's a business after all. But in the newsroom, we still wanted to do something that had some news value. We didn't want to just throw anything up there. So we were always looking for paranormal type stories to run on Friday nights, UFOs. And then in March 1997, of course, just literally fell out of the sky, the Phoenix Lights sighting, mass UFO sightings across the valley, across Arizona. You know, hundreds of people saw these lights in the sky, didn't know what they were. Our phones rang off the hook. I remember running upstairs with a bunch of other people to the roof to see if we could see anything, but we missed it. I didn't get to see it. But some of our reporters saw it. There was one, Jim Schnabel, who was out walking his dog. He saw the lights. Subsequently, we did some stories about the Phoenix Lights, of course. And as opposed to some other media outlets and newspapers, we took these stories very seriously. We did not make fun of it. We did not criticize people who saw these things. We interviewed them. We put their words on the air, straight reporting, no opinion. We just did the stories because, after all, if we had made light of these stories, made fun of them, then the people who were watching X-Files wouldn't like that very much. Mm-hmm. So we took it all very seriously. And along came a guy shortly after Phoenix Lights. I met a guy by the name of Tyler Pauly. He was very interested in this subject, kind of a UFO researcher in his own right. Introduced me to some of the people who had seen the Phoenix Lights, who had investigated it. Some of them at Village Labs, which you know about. You were associated with them at the time.
Sure.
And we talked to some of the people who were just reamed, raked over the coals for their opinions on what the Phoenix Lights were. We were even criticized. The work that we had done was criticized in the New Times, along with some other people who spoke out about the Phoenix Lights. Anyway, to make a long story short, Tyler had helped us do several stories. We had gone up to Area 51. We had Jim Schnabel. We sent him to McCarran Airport in Las Vegas, where these mysterious white planes were taking off every day, allegedly going up to Groom Lake, Area 51. Of course, we didn't get in, but he tried. And we did a lot of stuff on UFOs and other strange things. But one day, Tyler Pauly came to me and said, "Rod, are you ready to take this to the next level?" And I thought, uh-oh, you know, what is Tyler bringing to us now? And he told me about you. Jerry Wills is a healer. He can heal people with a touch. He's an incredible guy. He's helped a lot of people. And if you're ready to take it a step further, I think you guys should do a story about Jerry. So, you know, I'm a journalist by nature. I don't believe anything at face value. I'm a skeptic. As like I said in the introduction of the book, I've always been, most real journalists are skeptics. They don't believe anything at first. You got to show me. Mm-hmm. So I took a leap of faith, and I thought, okay, let's do this. So Tyler set up a shoot with you and a stroke victim, I believe it was.
Steve Wynum.
Yeah, out in the East Valley somewhere, I think. And I what I usually do is I don't always produce stories myself. I assign a reporter and a photographer to go out, shoot the story, then we discuss it, spend a couple days, do a nice job, put it together, and get it ready for the 9 p.m. news. In this case, Friday nights after X-Files. Mm-hmm. So I sent our reporter out to do the story, explained it to her. She kind of, you know, typical reaction, she rolled her eyes a little bit. I said, okay, you know, go out, let's check it out, and we'll talk about it when you get back. So she went out and did the story, and she came back, and her eyes were like saucers. She was just, Rod, you can't believe this. This is a great story. This guy is amazing. He's about 8 feet tall. He healed this guy. There are medical records. The doctors don't know how he did it. He was a stroke victim on his deathbed. The doctors had given up. Jerry came in and worked on this guy, and now he's talking, he's awake, and he's recovering from a stroke. So we put the story together, put it on the air. It got a great response, high rating. And then after that, you know, I'm not sure at what point I actually met you face to face. I think we talked on the phone a couple times.
Yeah, but you invited me down to the station.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, a long time ago.
Yeah, it's been a while.
The memory's slipping. The memory's going. But we definitely got together shortly after that and did a couple more stories, because when TV news finds a hit, we're gonna write it for all it's worth, of course. So we did some more stories, and they were always a rating success. My boss, the news director, would come to me, you know, once every few months and say, hey, it's time for another Jerry Wills story. Let's do one. So they were always good stories, amazing stuff. And it was just something that, you know, struck a chord. And then a few years later, you know, after we've been doing this for a while, I approached you about the idea for writing a book. And I told you that I was going to approach it like a journalist would. Like a TV news, like a big TV news story, really, is how I approached it. Mm-hmm. Or a long newspaper article, because it wasn't right from the beginning. And I explained this in the introduction of the book. It's not really a typical biography. It's a examination of what you do and how you do it, along with a little history about healing, some other research that's been done in the field. And so it's not your typical biography. I'm not trying to convince anyone of anything. I'm just laying out the story as it happened. You know, if there are extensive interviews with you, extensive interviews with people you worked on, watching you do some of what you do, it's basically a description of what goes on, and I leave it up to the reader to decide for themselves. Much the same way we approached TV news story about you. Here's what happened, ABCD, you know, is we never opinionated on it. We never judged. We never did any of those things. We just presented the story and let the viewer decide. So I approach the book the same way. Here's what Jerry is. Here's what he does. Here's some of the amazing things that happen. Here's what the people he works on say. It doesn't work all the time. But when it does, it's like a miracle. And without judgment, without opinion, you know, here's what happens. You can believe it or don't believe it. That's up to the reader. And so that's the kind of way I approached it. It's not your typical biography, but just spending all that time with you and talking to different patients, both in person and on the phone for the book, was really a fascinating experience for me. Unlike anything I'd ever done before, and it was a lot of work, but it was really worth it. I think you and I and Kathy's help, you know, we accomplished something that I'm proud of.
Well, I'm certainly proud of it. It has made a big difference for a lot of people who've read it, You know, I have some people tell me they're on a third reading of it. You know, I mean, personally, because it's about me, it isn't something that I could just sit there and read. It's difficult to read about yourself in that capacity.
Sure.
And I know all along the way, much to the bane of your existence, I was dragging my feet here, there, and elsewhere because this... And I'm still kind of that way, Rod. Even doing this new series, the Healer series, which this show is the first part of an ongoing thing we're going to be doing, talking about myself is it's a bit hard to do.
Oh, I'm sure. I understand that.
You know, I mean, when I was being covered by Fox, you know, and it was over the course of like 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about twice a year. You know, when I would sit down with you, I was a lot more comfortable with you. And there were a couple of reporters that was actually very easy to do an interview with. They had to pull it out of me to get what they were looking for, because I was just reticent to start talking about myself, because I don't know, it's just a weird thing. Some people say, oh, well, you're so humble. I don't know, I maybe, but I was feeling a little embarrassed because of all the attention.
Sure.
You know, if I'm up on stage playing music, I'm not embarrassed at all. That's fun. You know, that's a whole different genre. But you remember the story with Kelly, mm-hmm. the Tonga fellow.
Mm-hmm.
That was a hell of a story.
Yeah, it was.
And
I mean, a nice chapter in the book too. A really interesting guy, interesting story.
Yeah, and for you who aren't familiar with this story, this is a fellow who's really a mountain of a man, very very peaceful, gentle fellow. He liked to sing in church. He's just a good guy from Tonga. And he had been attacked by, you know, 2, 3, 4 people in a park, beaten in the head with a shovel, kicked in the head and around the face with steel-toed boots. And by the time that, you know, he got to the hospital, he was not expected to live. And at the time, I don't know if you knew this or not, Rod, but there was a woman who was a philanthropist that whenever there was something like this that would happen within the scope of what she knows or she'd heard about, she would call me up and say, I need you to go to this hospital and try to help this person. The money is already in the bank.
That's in the book. We talked about that at the time. Yeah, I remember that.
And so I went, and I had no idea that they had told his wife they didn't expect him to live through the night. And anyway, the results were really quite good. He did live. And if you folks haven't seen that story, you know, it might be out there someplace. It might even be on YouTube. But that was just one of quite a few stories. Are there any of the stories that you remember that particularly stick with you?
Just referencing the Kelly story, that was incredible. And fortunately they lived in the valley, so I was able to go and talk to them, he and his wife, at length for the book, a lot more in depth than we did for the story. But they're an amazing amazing couple. It was an amazing story. Who was the name escapes me right now, the disc jockey who had back problems?
That was Dennis McBroom.
Dennis McBroom, yeah. That was really good. He was quite a guy. Had all kinds of back issues, had gone to several specialists, was on all kinds of drugs for back pain, and then he met you, and boom, they were gone. He was, I actually saw him riding a horse at a ranch in South Phoenix, And for somebody who had a history of back problems, you would never know it. He was just 100% without drugs, without any kind of prescriptions.
Sure.
In fact, he told me he took all his bag full of drugs and pain patches and all that stuff and took it back to the doctor and said, here, give this to somebody else because I don't need it anymore. You know, Jerry Wills worked on me and I'm 110%, feel like a new man. So that was a good story. We did a TV story on him. And also I interviewed him later for the book. I was careful not to use, the book doesn't have, you know, verbatims from the stories with Fox 10, because that would create a conflict of interest. So I had to go back and talk to people who we had already done stories on. I went back and talked to them some more for, you know, a lot more detail that's in the book and not just repeating what we did on Fox 10. And Dennis was great. He did a great job. I liked that one. What other stories did you like?
Or so, well, many? I know there are quite a few. Tony Arnold's brother had a tumor in his brain. You remember that one?
Mm-hmm. Sure did.
And when I first worked on him, he had a shunt in his head because the tumor had closed off one of the ventricles that allow fluid to wash over the brain and then get strained away somehow. I don't know how that works. When I saw him, I took a look inside and I saw that, well, I saw the tumor, but he had brain swelling. His wife was a nurse. And they were visiting here from another state. And when I took a look, I said, you've got to go to the hospital right now. Don't stop, you know, for anything else. Just go directly to the hospital. Tell the brain surgeon that you've got swelling on the brain because this thing they implanted into you isn't working. And also tell them the reason it isn't working is because they put it in upside down and in the wrong place.
That's right. I remember that. And then they fixed it, right?
Yeah, they. I talked to the brain surgeon. They took a look at it, or he did, and said, it's backwards. They hooked it up backwards. He had just recently gotten it. And he also was telling me, before they did surgery on this fellow, that you know, they didn't think it was in the right place because it was located kind of high inside the skull. And this doctor actually was very curious because he couldn't figure out how I would know this. He said, are you a brain surgeon? You know, he was from India. He said, how do you know this? Because I could just see it. And he says, if you were going to put it somewhere else, where would you put it? And so I told him, you know, pointing to my skull, putting it down lower so that it would work properly. So they did that. He was fine. When you did the story about him, he still had the tumor. And I remember being over there in Chandler. You wanted a bit of a reenactment of me working on his head. But I figured it was a prime opportunity to actually do something that I wasn't able to do before because the guy was in so much trouble. So on camera, I worked on this fellow and I got rid of the tumor. When he went back for his scan, whatever kind of scan they did, they told him that he didn't need the shunt any longer. His tumor was completely gone. And it was supposed to be something that would never happen. But yeah, you're right. There are so many.
Yeah. I remember the first one I did with you. Again, I don't normally go out to do stories as executive producer. You're supposed to stay in the newsroom and act like a boss.
Sure.
It's kind of a middle manager position. But every once in a while, I would, you know, hey, I'm going to go out and do this with myself because I was really interested in it. And the second one we did, you know, after I was that first story, and the reporter was so impressed, I said, I've got to meet this guy. So I don't know if you remember, it was in South Phoenix. It was a young woman from Poland, I think.
Yeah,
it was like an exchange student or something like that. She'd had a stroke, and she was living with this couple in South Phoenix. And when we went in there to meet her, she could, you know, barely speak. She couldn't move. I think it was her left arm. She couldn't move her left arm at all. And while the camera's rolling, you worked on her, especially on her arm. And within 10, 15 minutes, she was moving her arm normally. And that was just, and the smile on her face, you know, said it all, that she made a remarkable recovery just in those few minutes that you were there, that we were there with you. I think that was the second story we aired.
It is.
Now, I think that was the first time I was with you during healing. And what I do, when I go out and do a story, I'm not on air. I stay behind the camera. I write it for one of the anchors. You know, when there's somebody or another reporter, I'll write the story myself, produce it, get somebody to voice it, and we put it on the air. So that's because I was always, for good reasons, I was always behind the camera, never in front. But it was fascinating to get out and do that story with you and get to know what it was all about. And I just remember the photographer and I looking at each other like, holy cow, that just happened. No, it was fascinating.
Yeah, I remember that one quite well, too. I wish that you guys had stuck around for a few more hours. Because what happened at about 12:30 that same day, as you guys had left only an hour before, as I recall, there was a fellow who, excuse me, drove down from Kingman. He was in a van. His wife had driven him. He was in a wheelchair. He couldn't get into that place we were living in at the time. So we had steps coming up, and he couldn't get up the steps. This man had been in I think it was Vietnam, and some explosion had burned him over most of his body. And he was always in excruciating pain. So here we are, out there, just beyond the carport, in the sun. He's out there in the sun. Wheel him over underneath the shade of the carport, and he's really quite disfigured from this. He was burned up pretty bad. I worked on him, and within about 10-15 minutes he had no pain at all, and he was just sitting there sobbing because it's the first time and I guess decades that he really just didn't have any pain at all.
Wow. Yeah, I'm sorry we missed that.
Yeah, that would have been a good one. The next day, there was a woman from South Phoenix. Her husband drove her there because she was blind. I was wishing you were there for this one, too. Kathy, of course, saw these things and was just, you know, always shaking her head, pretty much like, you know, you were too, and the others. I worked on her, took about 15 minutes or so. And when I finished, she could see.
Wow.
So she was anxious to get going. She grabbed the keys from her husband, ran out, and I saw her driving off. Kathy was just like, what the hell just happened here?
I'll bet.
But yeah, you have been around for a great many years and seen quite a few of these things.
Yes, I have.
When you started seeing, I mean, the first time you heard about it was Steve Minot in, you know, Chandler.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He was, they called me in because they were going to unplug him. His insurance had run out.
Right.
He's on life support. Mm-hmm. And they were going to unplug him. And it was like, well, if you can't do anything, you know, he won't be alive tomorrow.
Right.
So, you know, that's one story. But when you started getting more involved into the stories, you started seeing more and more of this. What did you think?
Well, you know, you see this happening right in front of you. And one of the first things that interested me in this case, in the Steve case especially, is what doctors are saying about this. How can they explain it? You know, you want to know that this guy's, is he really healed or not? Again, from a skeptic point of view at the time.
Sure.
And the thing that interested me most about the Steve Mino case was that there was documentation. There were documents written by the doctors in the hospital that said this was a miraculous recovery. It was right there. You know, the doctor wrote it down. They are always reluctant to go on television and talk about it because I think it's better now. You see hospitals that actually include faith or energy healing as a service in the hospital. Mm-hmm. But back then, it was still kind of new, and doctors didn't really want to talk about it much. So it helped me to understand what was going on, to appreciate what was going on. And I think it helped our viewers when we actually had documentation that this person had made a miraculous, unexplained recovery. And we had that in the Steve Mino case. That's one of the things that Tyler Pauley had helped us with, get that documentation from the hospital. And that really helped. From my point of view, again, as a skeptic journalist by training, I was, you know, that kind of stuff just blew me away. It was fantastic. I mean, the stories were incredible. The things that you could do to help these people and to actually have hospital, you know, reaction to it or doctor reaction to it in some form was helpful. Really helped, I think, convince me and others that this is that you're the real deal.
So it got to the point where you and I were hanging out a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were there with quite a few of the people I worked with. I mean, mm-hmm. not always, there's always so many, but you were there with quite a number of the people that I worked with.
Yeah, do you remember, it's in the book, do you remember the time we went and saw a couple of horses out at Gilbert?
Yeah, Quasar.
Quasar, yeah. Quasar was the older horse. The younger one, I can't remember her name.
I don't either.
That the person had called you to come out and look at their horse. It was a younger horse. We were out at the rodeo grounds out in Gilbert, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And there were just two horses there. One you had been called to take a look at. Its leg was bothering it. And I'm watching you work on this horse, and you actually would say something like lift this leg, and the horse would lift its leg. It was just I'm just like, oh my god, you know.
Yeah.
There wasn't a photographer there at the time. This was just for the book. We didn't do a story. It was just you and me for the book. And the horse was clearly limping at first, and you worked on the horse for a while, and then it was fine. But there was a second horse there, an older one. Quasar was the older horse. It wasn't the horse you were called in to work on. But Quasar kept coming over and nuzzling you, trying to get your attention while you're working on this other horse. And the other horse ran around the corral afterwards, was much better. You could definitely tell that horse was feeling 100% better. And Quasar came over and started bugging you. He said, okay, buddy, I'll work on you next. Just wait, I'll work on you next. And this horse was older and understood everything you said. Again, lifting its leg on command, it had a shoulder problem, front shoulder. And at one point, you said, take a deep breath.
Oh, yeah.
And the horse literally inhaled a huge breath. You could hear it. And you said, let it out. And you could hear the horse let the breath out. The dust flew up in front of it. Horses could take a big breath.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. It was one of the craziest things I ever saw. And then afterwards, which is very interesting, you talked to the owner of the first horse. He said, something's really bothering these horses. They don't like it here. There's something here that they don't like. They really don't like it, like being in this corral and this on this rodeo grounds. And a third person who was there, a friend of the horse owner, I believe, spoke up and said, this used to be a landfill. And all of a sudden, it just made perfect sense. Horses didn't like it because they're on a landfill. And, you know, God only knows what's in this landfill. The horses could sense it, that it was a bad place to be. And they wanted to get out of there. And I think they did move the horses out of there. what? It was amazing that you could feel that from the horses. The horses knew it was a bad place. They communicated that with you. You expressed it. And then somebody else says, we're on a landfill. So that was fascinating. That was an interesting day.
Quasar was supposed to be dangerous.
No, he wasn't. He was very friendly.
They were all freaking out because Quasar was loose and he doesn't like people.
Yeah. He came right up to you.
Yeah. And the owner, actually, I remember very clearly, came over and said, well, if you want him, you can have him. So I had a flip phone, call Kathy, and I said, you'll never guess what. This guy just gave me a horse. His name is Quasar. I like him.
Right.
As, what are you going to do with a horse? Where are you going to keep a horse? I was like, I don't know. It's like a dog, you know, backyard, living room. And Kathy wouldn't hear of it.
Yeah.
So the gal that owned that horse, her father took the horse up to Wyoming. And its
I'm
last
sure it
episode.
Was a lot happier. Yeah, I'm oh, sure yeah. it was a lot happier up there.
Had to have been.
That was a fascinating day. I remember you saying, that's a great horse. I wish I could take him home.
Yeah. I would have taken him home, too, if I'd had a home to take him to. But Kathy just wasn't too keen on that.
Yeah, I can see that. My wife probably wouldn't be either.
Yeah, wives are like that.
They are.
I should have just brought the horse home and said, guess what? We're going to save on fuel.
Now, one thing I think, this is a suggestion, but you should probably talk to your viewers about, and we spent quite a bit of time in the book, and we talked about this a lot, and how you actually do this. You know, what do you see? What do you do? How do you heal? How does it work? And I know we talked a lot about that for the book, and I did my best to explain it. Like I said before, unlike a typical biography, it's more like a newspaper story in that I quote you a lot. I use you word for word. We spend a lot of time together for the book, many, many evenings just talking. I would record the conversations and use a lot of verbatim stuff in the book because I wanted to be accurate. Again, that's my training. I wanted to be accurate to a fault on exactly how this happens. So I think it'd be worthwhile to your viewers in this healing series to actually, I mean, I can describe what you told me, but it would be better coming from you, I think, on a lot better coming from you on how does it work?
Yeah, well, you know, I'll take that advice and I'll run with it. You know, just like everything else, trying to, you know, for me, going into some detail, how do you do the nuts and bolts of this? Typically, as you well know, I talk about someone I've worked on, and I just give it a real quick brush over. Well, they had this wrong, and I fixed it.
Right. And I had to dig a little bit to get some of the details out of you at the time.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, I think in this series I will go into greater depth, because there's a lot of depth to it.
You know, oh, yeah.
There are a lot of details there. Mm-hmm. But, I don't know, well, maybe this is a good time, you know, this age we're in currently, to go into those details and try to explain it comprehensively.
Yeah, I think people want to know. That's why I put it in the book, or try to at least.
So at some point, I worked on you and others.
Mm-hmm.
What was your experience like?
I remember one time, I know you worked on my back because I had back problems, and they were always better after you worked on them. But there was one time, and we get into this a little bit. I had spent a couple hours with you at the shop here in Phoenix at the time where you were working on electronics. And I think I offhandedly said, my wrist is really bothering me. I had broken it two places when I was in high school playing basketball on a bad fall. And it back in the 70s, you know, doctors would take an x-ray, yeah, it's broken, put a cast on it and say good luck. Nowadays you'd have surgery, they put in pins and rods and things like that. But back in the 70s when this happened, it was just, you know, put it in a cast. So it's never really healed correctly, and it's always bothered me a little bit. And you said, oh, we'll have to fix that. I said, okay, yeah, that'd be great. But we went on with the interview, and a couple hours later, I left, didn't think anything about it. I'm driving home, and all of a sudden, I feel this intense heat in my wrist. It was like it was not on fire, but it was very warm. And all of a sudden felt a lot better. That sharp pain that I usually had in it was gone. So I immediately got on my flip phone and called you. I said, Jerry, what did you do? And you told me that you remotely, because the guy had just been there, but remotely you were able to dial in your consciousness to me, to where I was in the car, and throw some energy into that wrist so that it would feel better. And that was very eye-opening. I don't know if you remember that, but for me, that was quite an experience.
You know, actually, I remember it now, but I haven't thought about that in years. That's probably one of the very first times I worked on someone remotely was with you.
Was it? Yeah.
Yeah, I do it all the time now.
And it worked, yeah. Yeah, you can. I know you've done it over the phone. Mm-hmm. You work on people while you're talking to them on the phone. We talk about that in the book. And remotely, it's an incredible gift.
Yeah. Surprises some folks.
Yeah, surprise me.
How's your wrist now?
It still gives me problems. It comes and goes. It's okay right now. But it's still, you know, it's just one of those things that I'll aggravate it, you know, I'll lean on it the wrong way or something, and it goes, you know, ouch.
Yeah,
but it's nothing. It's been better ever since then.
It might have something to do with age, Rod.
Most likely it has a lot to do with age.
I've noticed a few things a little achy here and there.
Yeah, they get a little, yeah, stiff. Yeah, can't quite do everything I used to do. I sure don't play basketball anymore, that's for sure.
So what was it like in the newsroom when you would do one of these stories? And, you know, I mean, there were other folks around. I mean, was there any interest or curiosity there?
Well, there was a lot of interest and curiosity. It was fun to not just do the stories myself, but also assign them to somebody so that they would go out and experience it firsthand and come back and say, holy cow. You know, I know there was other reporters, Sabre Gurch, Steve Kraft, a lot of reporters that I worked a lot with, were really, every time they came back, they would just go, wow, this is really impressive. One of the challenges in the newsroom, and I'm not going to name names, is that some people are just, they won't believe any of this. They are skeptics and you cannot convince them of anything. Some of them were anchors on the air. I remember, even before we did stories about you, when we were doing Phoenix Light stories, you know, like I said before, we would take it very seriously and do straight reporting job because we didn't want to offend anyone. We didn't want to, remember, this is just a local Fox station. We don't do mm-hmm. opinion. We just do just the facts, ma'am, you know, kind of a thing. Right. So we're just doing a straight story. And sometimes we'd come after the story aired, come back on set. Someone would make us, you know, a smart, silly remark about it. And that would get us into trouble sometimes. You know, people would call and say, well, so-and-so doesn't believe this. You know, what's the deal? What are you doing? You know, they would get upset with us because of a comment someone else made, not because of the actual story.
Mm-hmm.
So they're always going to be, you know, I call them super skeptics. I know that's a word that's been used before. It's fairly common, but super skeptics that won't believe anything. I mean, they believe Phoenix Lights. They believe it was flares dropped by A-10s out at the gunnery range, you know, 2 hours after the sighting. And that was an excuse the Air Force came up with about 3 months later. They said it was flares out at the gunnery range, which was miles and miles from where the sightings actually occurred, and about 2 hours later. But for some in the newsroom, that was it. Now, I know some other TV stations in Phoenix said it's flares. You know, you people are all nuts. It was just flares dropped by the Air Force, but we knew it wasn't. We had interviewed so many people. We had interviewed air traffic controllers. We had an audio tape from the UFO reporting center of an airman out at Luke Air Force Base saying the pilots who came back from the intercept mission were scared to death by what they saw. I mean, this was really, you know, straight good reporting from eyewitnesses. But there were some that never accepted it. Now, as far as, you know, stories about you and healing, same thing. You know, there are always going to be super skeptics, especially in a place like a newsroom, where you're trained to be skeptical. You're trained not to accept anything at face value.
Sure.
And no matter how much length you go to, you know, to investigate and report something that's happening, it's right in front of our eyes, right in front of the camera. Some people blow it off as fraud, and we I even discuss fraud a little bit in the book. I made the example of, you know, fraud is everywhere. Okay, there are fraudulent contractors out there ripping you off. There are fraudulent doctors practicing without a license. You hear about it all the time. There are lawyers ripping people off, not doing any work and charging them, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. There's fraud in every profession. But does that mean everyone in that profession is a fraud? No. There are legitimate doctors and lawyers, contractors who will do the work on time and under budget. Same thing with healing. Same thing with UFO investigators. They're not. You can't just make this blanket statement that everybody's a fraud. Everybody who does this is a fraud, because that's not true.
Yeah, well, that's a valid point. And I've run into people in the healing arts that, you know, I had to shake my head and just wonder, what are they thinking?
Yeah.
You know, different from some people, I see energy around people, and I see the result of the energy they're trying to use when they're doing their healing work, and they don't know that I do. And it's like, it's a bit of an eye opener. But you know, it's not really my place to jump in and go, "Hey, what are you doing?"
I know we talked about this. There was a Dr. Gary Schwartz down at the University of Arizona had done some interesting work with mediums at first. The medium experiments or something like that, wrote a book, had done a lot of blind studies with mediums and contacting the dead, double blind scientific studies. This is a Harvard trained professor at the University of Arizona. And they did some remarkable work. And then just about the time I was writing the book, they were doing the healing experiments. They brought in some other healers, energy healers of different, you know, philosophies, different ways of doing things. But they also did a double blind study, and it was fascinating to interview Dr. Schwartz. He had healers come in, and there would be a plant, okay, a potted plant that they would work on. The exact same plant from the same seed grafted into a different plant as a control. Mm-hmm. And these healers would, you know, run energy, as they call it, as you call it sometimes, put energy into these plants without touching them. They're carefully observed, and each healer would run energy into this plant. And a week later, it would be twice the size of the other one. And they were both kept under the exact same conditions, exact same amount of light, same amount of water and nutrients. But in almost every case, I think it was every case, the healers that ran energy into their plant as opposed to the control plant, the difference was startling. It wasn't, in no way it could be a fluke, because it happened over and over again. Mm-hmm. One of the tenets of science: can come up with a theory, test it, and repeat it. get repeated results over and over and over again. And that's exactly what they had. And it was a fascinating interview, and to see their results. They later published a book called The Healing Experiments, which is a good read. And if anyone's interested, and it was the same kind of thing, you know, they, as a scientific, serious scientific study of healing, energy healers like yourself, that conducted those experiments, and the results were amazing.
I had a scientist from north of San Francisco. I don't remember his name or specifically where it was at. He contacted me about 2 years ago. He was taking off doing the same kind of experiments, but then at this point, instead of plants, it was people. And invited me to come up there, and I had to work on 3 people a day for 2 weeks, weekends off. Everything sounded really good about it. You know, they didn't have any budget, just on my, you know, good graces to do it. But the caveat was, I can't talk to the people, I can't touch the people. I show up, I do my thing at a distance, and walk away. And I said, no, I don't do it that way. It's not how it's done. Not when I do it. Well, the other healers are doing it that way. I said, well, what kind of results are you getting? He says, well, you know, little changes here and there with what we've done so far. We wanted to have you come in for, you know, the 2 weeks and see what, because we've heard about you. And I said, well, if you want me to do that, then it's going to be my way or not at all. He said, well, we can't do it that way because none of the others were allowed to touch these people either. I said, all right, then, you know, I'm not going to do it. And I didn't. I've gotten like 3 calls over the past 18 months. We'll do it your way. Just come up and, you know. I don't think so.
Yeah, probably wouldn't be a good idea. but at least, you know, people are, it's become more mainstream. People are talking about it more. Even when we read, you know, it was 13, 14 years ago when we wrote the book. Mm-hmm. You hear more about it all the time now. I remember we did a story that I retired 2 years ago, so it was probably 5 years ago. There was a hospital chain in the Valley. I don't remember which one, but they were offering, you know, that kind of mind body healing service that would have been, you know, laughed off 15 years ago. It's interesting.
Maybe, you know, with these shows on Fox and the work that I've done, you know, you guys covering it, that might have been the impetus for saying there is a possibility of something here.
You know, there's no doubt it contributed.
Yeah. So, you know, some good came of this. Mm-hmm. You know, and like I tell other folks, you know, sure, I'm a healer. I do this sort of thing. But I'm not the only one. And I'm not the best there is, I'm sure.
There's gonna be something. I'll bet you're right up there, pal.
Well, I'll tell you something that was embarrassing to me. Well, embarrassing to talk about. When I was told this, it was like, oh, gee, and I sort of blushed, I think. There was, you know who Ingo Swann is, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Ingo, we were good friends with Ingo Swann. And I think because he liked Kathy so much, that's the reason. But there was another fellow. His name was Dr. Safwat El Amin. This guy was a character. He's Egyptian, a doctor. He could do things that were pretty profound. He put a quarter on my eye, this eye, and held it there with his finger, and the quarter just bent around his finger. You know how stiff a quarter is. Safwat could take 3 steps and just vanish into thin air.
Wow.
And then a little while later, he'd be in the room. Well, there you are. He'd have In this particular instance, he had a newspaper, the daily newspaper from Cairo, in his hands. He had jumped, basically. There are several instances where I know about him jumping from one place to the other. As a matter of fact, he was on a jet plane heading to Miami when we were down there, and he got tired of riding on the plane, so he just jumped from the plane and was in the airport waiting to be picked up. I asked him, why didn't you just jump over to the house? I didn't know where you lived. Anyway.
We talked about this before in the past, too, that, you know, in the United States and Western Europe, we're so conditioned to believe everything Western medicine tells us to do,
yeah,
and how to react to things, and medically or otherwise. Where in the Far East, there's much more of this. It's the whatever you want to call it, energy healers, faith healers. They have one in every village.
In
the Amazon, South America, for sure. South America and Far East, this is a much more accepted method of healing that they've done for centuries, you know, that's much more accepted than it is in the West. Although that, like I said, that is improving, I believe, by leaps and bounds. It's still, you know, healthcare is still dominated by big insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, and Western medicine. But it's changing. I don't think it probably will never change as much as it is in South America and other places, but it's a part of things that are, you know, happening now for people, which is a good thing.
Well, you know, a lot of folks have this, they don't like doctors, they don't like hospitals, they don't like medical procedures.
That's right.
They just don't like it. They don't trust it. And so when I'm working with someone, they are like, you know, what do you think about that? And I tell them, there's a place in the world for that. I mean, that's science.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, there are reasons why you should be respecting the doctors and what they know. But like everyone else, no one has all the answers, and they try to do the best they can.
Right, sure.
You know, I refer a lot of people to doctors. You know, because there are things that they need, like that guy with the brain tumor, you know.
Yeah.
The gal.
You need to go to the hospital. Yeah.
Yeah, there's this gal that, older lady, her daughter, a doctor, brought her to see me because I'd already worked on the daughter. And the gal just, you know, we were just visiting Phoenix at the time. We were staying in a hotel room. So here's this older lady. Could you help my mom? I said, yeah, let me see what's going on. I put my hand on her, took a look inside, and I said, okay, I want you to be very happy and very calm and take some deep breaths and go directly to the hospital. She had been sitting there 5 minutes. Why? Because you are that close to a very serious issue, and only the doctors can help you. Well, as it turns out, she'd had a couple of stents, you know, years before. And what I saw was there's a blood clot around her heart that was, she was going to die. And I said, tell the doctor. I told the daughter. I didn't tell the older lady. I said, tell the doctor, there's a problem with the stents. There's a blood clot. It's close to letting loose, and she's not going to live very long if that happens. Get to the hospital and tell them that I said this is what's going on. Have them find out if I'm right or not. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, she was admitted to the hospital. She had surgery within hours, and they said that I had saved her life because I'd done just that. Not everything is something I can fix.
I remember we did not do a news story on it, but you remember The Amazing Ron?
Oh, sure.
That was a great story. Tell us about that one.
Oh, well. I was in Florida. I'd been flown out there to work on someone. And, you know, a lot of times you get people come to me when it's like they're so far gone, what the hell am I going to do? You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like they're on death's doorstep. If I had gotten to them like a month before, maybe I could have been a bit more effective. Anyway, I was there for that reason. I did the best I could, went back to my hotel. I had not eaten all day long. So I'm in the room, and talk to Kathy, and I have people on the other side that I hear, that I talk to sometimes. M.
Yeah.
Just the letter M. Don't know. Can't explain it. So M says, you want a Pepsi? And I said, because I'm thinking, I haven't eaten. And he says, you know, you want a Pepsi? No, I don't. Yeah, you do. Go get a Pepsi. The machine's just right outside the door. Go get a Pepsi. Do it now. So I got up, went to the door, went over there. I had a $5 bill in my hand, and would you know, that machine takes dollar bills. And so M says, well, go down to the lobby and get change. You want a Pepsi? So I go down to the lobby. I walk up there, and there are these two people, a man and a woman, that are coming in out of an ambulance that had been dropped off. He's got his arm, you know, taped like a wound here, you know, and they both look pretty damn beat up. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, that's trippy. They walk up to the desk. They get there before I do. They're talking to this fellow. And I'm just there to get change. Apparently, I want a Pepsi, which I don't. Long story short, I struck up a conversation with them. They had just been in a very serious car accident. They'd been hurt, and this was where they were going to stay. They were driving back to New Jersey, and this accident occurred. Damn near killed them both. Ended up eventually getting the Pepsi, which I didn't drink much of. And I told them who I was, what I did, and if you're interested, you know, give me a call. Got back to the room. I'm thinking about giving Kathy a call. The room phone rings. Sure, you want to come on down? Okay. Mm-hmm. I went down. Ron had fractured his spine and part of his neck up here someplace in this car accident. He was in a lot of pain. He couldn't turn his head. He couldn't bend over. And his wife, Paige, she was hurt as well. Shoulder, I think. Maybe her knee. I went down, visited with him, had a great time, drank my Pepsi, and I worked on his back. When I got finished working on his back, he was turning his head all over the place. He was bending over, touching the floor, coming back up, twisting his back. It was snapping and popping, and he's like, oh, that feels good. And he's feeling great. Paige, I worked on her, and then I discovered that there was something wrong inside of her head. She had a blood vessel that was going to go into an aneurysm. I told her, and she was pretty freaked out because her mother had died of this. I think she had died of this, as I recall. So I fixed it. She'd been having headaches and headaches and headaches for the longest time. After I worked on it, her headache went away, and she was fine thereafter. And that's how I met the amazing Ron. He's a palmist. Paul reads the palms. And just a hell of a nice guy. But that's the story.
Yeah, that's great. I, of course, I wasn't there for your healing. But I did talk to them at length several months later. They still felt great. They were completely blown away by the experience. Very, very happy that they met you, because it was a really rough time for them. They were in, I think they were in Miami for a funeral, something like that, when the car accident happened. And great couple. They were very happy to talk to me about it, and they were very impressed by what happened. And I just thought they were a very neat couple. Hopefully I'll get to meet them someday.
Yeah, well, you'll enjoy it when you do. They're living in New Orleans now. Yeah. But, you know, the whole thing about go have a Pepsi, if I hadn't gone to get a Pepsi, right, none of that would have happened.
Right. Or well, you have some friends out there helping you out.
Yeah, well, here and there. We're coming a little past an hour, right about an hour right now of being live. Why don't we take a break? When we come back, I'll open the phone lines, and we'll take a few calls and see what else comes up, Rod.
Okay, sounds good.
This break is going to be 11 minutes long. Let me just find the break here. Oh, here we go. So you'll see on your screen the countdown timer. So I'll see you in just a little bit. And folks, don't go away. Phone lines will open up here in just a little while. And we'll take your calls if you have any questions for Rod, or if you have any questions for me. Either way, we'll take your calls no matter where you are in the world. All right. We kind of lost the video there while I keyed up the commercial break.
Okay. Kind of, my light's dying a little bit there. That's better. That was good.
Yeah, it was a good time.
That was fun. Yep, that was fun.
For you who are watching or listening, if you're on the radio, you'll be able to listen to some fantastic, wonderful stuff coming up right now. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a comment. Subscriptions and your comments cost nothing, but it really helps us out a lot. To hear the entire interview you were just listening to, and many, many other amazing interviews within our archives, please visit jerrywillsshow.com and become a member. Your membership supports our ongoing broadcasts. That's jerrywillsshow.com. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this program.